Gabriel.
Sorry about that, sir. Good day, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Great Lakes conference call. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. If anyone should require any operator assistance during the conference, please press star, then zero on your touch-tone telephone. I would now like to introduce your host for today's conference. Peter Berg, you may begin.
Thank you very much, Gabriel, and welcome to the ADA Audio Conference Series. The ADA Audio Conference Series is a project of the ADA National Network. The National Network is funded by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, Administration on Community Living, National Institute on Disability, Independent Living, and Rehabilitation Research. The ADA National Network is your leader in providing information and training on the Americans with Disabilities Act. You can reach your regional ADA center by calling 800-949-4232. We are very pleased to have with us today two speakers that joined us back in February, talking about the Air Carriers Access Act as it relates to related to service animals, companion animals, but we've brought them back, and we are fortunate that they agreed to present to a full session on the Air Carriers Access Act. So this session entitled Air Travelers with Disabilities and the Air Carrier Access Act. We are pleased to have with us LaVon Chapman, who is the Chief of the Aviation Civil Rights Compliance Branch Office of the General Counsel, U.S. Department of Transportation. And along with LaVon is Ann Hammond, who is a transportation consultant, also with the U.S. Department of Transportation. So I want to say welcome to LaVon and Ann and turn it over to them for today's presentation.
Thank you for that introduction, Peter. I think that Ann may want to correct her title just a little bit.
Oh, sure. Actually, I am a team leader, or the team leader, in the Aviation Consumer Protection Division. And so basically, I have the oversight over the analysts in our office for investigations regarding matters with disability in the Air Carrier Access Act.
Okay, so again, thank you, Peter. It's a pleasure to be here this afternoon. This presentation is intended to be an overview of Part 382. It is essentially Part 382-101. I'm attempting to, through this presentation, give everyone a flavor of what the provisions of Part 382 are, but I will not and cannot go into too much depth just for the sake of time and of ensuring that I don't confuse the audience. So I would like to start off this type of presentation with talking just really quickly about our office and our structure. We're one of seven offices in the Office of the General Counsel, which is in the Office of the Secretary of Transportation. The title of our office is the Office of Aviation Enforcement and Proceedings. We're split evenly in two in the office. One side of the house is by and large comprised of attorneys. The other side of the house is by and large comprised of analysts that are in the Aviation Consumer Protection Division. The analysts provide investigations generally for our office and interface with passengers and airlines, and the attorneys provide legal support and enforcement of Part 382. So it's important, too, to talk about jurisdiction. Often when folks think of matters related to aviation, The first thing that comes to mind is the Federal Aviation Administration. And sometimes we also get complaints from individuals as well that are dealing with security-related issues. As this slide shows here, the U.S. Department of Homeland Security is charged with the responsibility of providing security at airport checkpoints and ensuring that individuals don't board airplane that are on watch lists and the like, and train the TSA agents that are at checkpoints. The FAA is charged with the responsibility of ensuring the safety and efficiency of the air traffic system. They also have a component that deals with ADA and Section 504 Rehab Act provisions involving airport facilities. Our office, the Office of Aviation Enforcement and Proceedings, is concerned with issues related to air transportation. We're broken down into three main subject matter areas: consumer protection, civil rights, under which disability rights issues fall, and economic licensing. Just a little bit about the Air Carrier Access Act, or ACAA for short. The ACAA prohibits discrimination on the basis of disability in air travel and requires air carriers to accommodate the needs of passengers with disabilities. It also, in the statute itself, requires us to do a number of other things, which includes investigate each complaint alleging discrimination on the basis of disability, publish disability-related complaint data, which airlines provide to us every January, and we publish a report generally by around this time each year to Congress, and that report's also on our website or will be on our website, and we'll give you the web address toward the end of this presentation. We're also charged with implementing a plan to provide technical assistance on Part 382, which we have done in the past, and we're in the process now of updating the technical assistance given the number of amendments to Part 382 that have occurred. A little bit about the history of the ACAA. The Air Carrier Access Act was actually passed in 1986. It was passed after a court decision, a Supreme Court decision against the Paralyzed Veterans of America, which essentially said that airlines are not required to comply with the provisions of Section 504 of the Rehab Act because they're not direct recipients of federal financial funds. And so around 30 years ago, Congress acted quickly as a result of that decision and passed the Air Carrier Access Act. As the previous slide noted, it's really short on words, and it directed the department to promulgate rules to carry out its intent. The department engaged in a regulatory negotiation back in the 80s. And which ultimately did not reach consensus, but did provide basis for the department to publish a notice and comment rule. That rule was eventually published as a final rule in March of 1990. Since then, there have been more than 10 updates to the rule, amendments to the rule. We've also issued notice, quite a bit of guidance on the rule over the years. And importantly, that first rule did not apply to foreign air carriers. In April of 2000, Congress enacted a extension of the Air Carrier Access Act to make it apply to foreign air carriers. We issued guidance in May of 2000 indicating how we intended to carry out that new legislation, the new at the time legislation. And in 2008, we published a final rule which included foreign air carriers, among other things. on to substance. So who's covered by the Air Carrier Access Act? The rule applies to all U.S. carriers regardless of where their operations take place. For foreign carriers, the rule only applies to their flights that begin or end at a U.S. airport. For purposes of the rule, a flight means a continuous journey of a passenger in the same aircraft or using the same flight number. It's important to note that foreign carriers are not covered under the rule for operations between that are solely between two foreign points. And that's true even if they have a co-chair with a domestic carrier and there's an individual that's flying on their flight. If it's purely between two foreign points, foreign carriers aren't covered. So what practices and activities are covered? Generally, covered carriers must not discriminate against a qualified individual with a disability by reason of their disability in the provision of air transportation. Another key requirement is that carriers must not require an individual with a disability to accept special services. Carriers must also modify policies, practices, and facilities needed to provide non-discriminatory service consistent with the standards of Section 504 of the Rehab Act. However, covered carriers are not required to make modifications that constitute an undue burden or fundamentally alter their program. So, who is protected? A qualified individual with a disability. So generally, Part 382's definition of a qualified individual with a disability is similar to the ADA's definition. That definition is specifically any individual who has a physical or mental impairment that substantially limits one or more life activities, has a record of such an impairment, or is regarded as having such an impairment. The one notable key difference from the ADA is that in the definition of a qualified individual with a disability under the Air Carrier Access Act, the Air Carrier Access Act explicitly includes individuals with temporary disabilities. So if their disability is on a permanent or a temporary basis, you are covered as a under the definition of a qualified individual with a disability under the Air Carrier Access Act. Qualified individual with a disability includes passengers, which is anyone who offers to purchase or otherwise validly obtains a ticket for air transportation, and also anyone who is using the facilities. For example, someone who's accompanying and meeting the traveler, using ground transportation, using terminal facilities, or obtaining information about scheduled fares, reservations, policies, etc. One of the areas that is that we receive a number of complaints in, and Ann will talk a little bit more about the complaints that we receive. It's one of the bigger areas of Part 382 is the area dealing with boarding, deplaning, and connecting assistance. Part 382 requires carriers to assist passengers in getting on or off an airplane, including through the use of lifts and ramps. Requires carriers to provide assistance in between gates so that passengers can connect to other flights. It requires, while they're providing this assistance, to allow a passenger to access a key area of the terminal like baggage claim or a lavatory, the entrance to a lavatory. It requires carriers to provide assistance with checked or carry-on luggage as part of that assistance and to make a stop at a service animal relief area. And this assistance is essentially curb-to-curb. So what we mean by that is when an individual arrives at the airport and notifies an individual that represents the carrier that they're flying on, that they have arrived and that they need a specific type of assistance. The carrier's obligation is from that notification at the curb to the curb at their destination airport. One other thing that's not listed here is the requirement for pre-boarding. Carriers must permit a passenger with a disability to board an aircraft before all other passengers. If that passenger notifies the carrier at the gate that he or she needs additional time or assistance to board or stow accessibility equipment or to be seated as an accommodation for a disability. So aircraft accessibility, one of the other areas that Part 382 covers is the features that are required on an aircraft to make that aircraft accessible. One of those features is a movable alarm rest. For aircraft with 30 or more passenger seats, at least one half of the armrest on the aisle seats have to be movable. And this is true for each class of service on the aircraft. Carriers have to establish procedures to ensure that individuals with disabilities can readily obtain seating in rows with those movable aisle armrests. And an aisle seat is not required to have a movable armrest if a person with a disability would be precluded from sitting there by FAA safety rules, for example, an exit row. The rule also requires accessible lavatories for aircraft with more than one aisle. And for aircraft with more than 60 seats, the rule requires carriers to have an operable onboard wheelchair. If there's an accessible lavatory or if there is an accessible lav and the passenger provides advance notice that he or she can use an inaccessible lavatory, but needs an onboard chair to reach it. It also requires stowage space for wheelchairs, and we'll talk a little bit more about that later on in the presentation. Another big area in Part 382 is seating accommodations. This can be a bit of a complicated area. We'll discuss it at a rather high level. The thrust is that under Part 382, there are essentially four instances in which an individual with a disability is entitled to a specific seat assignment. The first is if a passenger uses an aisle chair to board and cannot readily transfer over a fixed aisle armrest. That passenger would be entitled to a seat in a row with a movable aisle armrest. That does not mean that the passenger must necessarily be seated in the front of the aircraft, but the carrier is required to provide a seat with a movable aisle armrest for a passenger that boards with an aisle chair. Also, carriers must be trained in the location and proper use of aisle chairs, including the appropriate transfer techniques. The second is when a passenger with a disability is traveling with a personal care attendant, or a person with a vision impairment is traveling with a reader assistant, or a person with a hearing impairment is traveling with an interpreter, or a person is traveling with a safety assistant. These are all instances in which a passenger must be given an adjoining seat for that individual to assist. They can't be in different rows, and again, carriers don't necessarily have to seat the individuals in the front of the aircraft, but they do need to be in adjoining seats. Um, If a passenger is traveling with a service animal or has a fused or immobilized leg, then under the rule, the passenger is entitled to a bulkhead seat. And this is really the only instance where the rule specifies that an individual should be toward the front of the aircraft if the bulkhead is toward the front of the aircraft. However, the rule also indicates or states that a carrier is not required to give a seat in a higher class of service. And this is an area that the department is contemplating dealing with in the context of a rulemaking. Many carriers have reconfigured the main passenger cabin to include such things as economy plus and equivalent types of services, and often now the bulkhead row is in that class of service. And under the rule, that is a different class of service. And as a consequence, unless a passenger has paid for that class of service or the airline has a policy that notwithstanding the class of service rules, they will still accommodate an individual with a fused or immobilized leg or who is traveling with a service animal in that bulkhead, carriers may, under the rule, or would not be under the rule required to seat a passenger in the bulkhead if they did not hold a ticket for that class of service. So we talked about service animals the last go-round. Just sort of to recap, carriers must permit dogs and other service animals to accompany a passenger with a disability. They're not permitted to impose charges for transporting the service animal. They may not deny transportation to a service animal on the basis that its carriage may offend or annoy others. Generally, they're not permitted to require documentation for a service animal unless the individual's verbal assurances that the service animal is indeed a service animal and that they are indeed a qualified individual with a disability are not credible. What's also not noted on the slide is something that during the last webinar that we had, we talked a little bit about emotional support animals. I don't want to get into all of the discussion about emotional support animals, but emotional support animals and psychiatric service animals are the one exception to the documentation rule. They can require documentation that's no more than a year old on the letterhead of a mental health professional that states that the individual has a mental or emotional disability recognized in the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, or DSM. That the passenger needs the emotional support or psychiatric service animal as an accommodation for air travel and or for the activity or for activity at the passenger's destination, that the individual providing the assessment is a licensed mental health professional and the passenger is under his or her professional care, and also including the date and type of the health professional's license. For emotional and psychiatric service animals. I'll touch upon it a little bit later in the presentation, but this is also the subject of a negotiated rulemaking that is currently ongoing with the department, and we'll talk just a little bit about that later on. So in 2003, we published an amendment to Part 382 that requires airline websites to be accessible to passengers with disabilities. And that rule was to be implemented in two parts. As of December of last year, December of 2015, the rule required airlines to ensure that the core travel information in services on their primary websites meet the web content accessibility guidelines, otherwise known as WCAG 2.0 level AA standard. It only applies to websites that market air transportation to the general public in the United States. Some of the characteristics of a primary website that markets the general public in the United States are such things as the content can be viewed in English, the site advertises or sells flights operating to or from the United States, and the site displays fares in U.S. dollars. And the core travel information portion of that rule means booking or changing a reservation, checking in for a flight, accessing a personal travel itinerary, accessing the status of a flight, accessing a personal frequent flyer account, flight schedules, and carrier contact information. Phase two of the rule is to occur this December. And that phase two requires that all remaining web pages of an airline's website conform to the WCAG 2.0 level AA standard. It's also important to note that as of last December, December 12, 2015, airlines were required by this rule to have an online accommodation request form available for passengers with disabilities to request services, accommodation services through the web, such as wheelchair assistance, seating accommodations, onboard stowage of an assistive device, just to name a few. We also published in 2013 well, let me back up just a moment. The rule, I mentioned earlier, a few slides earlier, that the rule also requires onboard wheelchair service stowage. It requires that airlines have a priority space in the cabin for a manual passenger wheelchair, and it specifies what the dimensions are, and it's to be a priority space that's not to be used for carry-ons, and only one wheelchair is required, and it applies for U.S. carriers to new aircraft with 100 or more passenger seats ordered or delivered quite some time ago, April 1990 and April 1992, respectively. And it applies to foreign carrier aircraft that were ordered after May 13, 2009 or delivered after May 13, 2010. However, almost 3 years ago now, we promulgated a rule that permitted the carriage of aircraft across a row of seats. It's known as the seat strapping rule, and it involves placing a folding passenger wheelchair across a row of seats using a strap kit that complies with FAA or other foreign government safety regulations. And carriers may elect to have a closet or to utilize the seat strapping procedure. But if they do elect to utilize the seat strapping procedure, they generally must transport two wheelchairs if requested. And if stowage of a wheelchair displaces passengers, those passengers who are displaced would be entitled to denied boarding compensation or compensation for passengers who are bumped, essentially. So some of our main focus areas are complaint handling, enforcement, rulemaking, and outreach. I talked a little bit about our rulemaking efforts. I'll talk a little bit more about our regulatory negotiation that we're engaged in a moment. One thing that I want to note here is that carriers, it's important for folks to know that carriers are required to designate one or more complaint resolution officials, or CROs, and make a CRO available to consumers either by phone or in person on request and at no charge whenever there is an issue raised about an accommodation that is required under Part 382. These individuals are intended to be the carrier experts on disability accommodations in air travel, and it's important to ensure that folks know that the rule requires airlines to have at least one individual that's available as a CRO if an individual has a question about the rule, or if or an accommodation, or if there's a problem that arises. They're required by the rule to have the authority to resolve complaints promptly. Often airlines simply train their supervisors and station managers as CROs. So generally, if an individual is not familiar with the specific terminology, CRO, they may ask to speak to a supervisor and explain that they've got a disability-related concern, and the supervisor should be able to assist them with that concern. It's also worth noting that airlines are required to respond to complaints. The rule requires them within 30 days of receipt of a complaint that either a passenger sends in directly or that the department sends to them to provide a dispositive written response, which must include a summary of the facts that were raised in the complaint, and they must specifically admit or deny that a violation occurred, and they've got to inform the complainant of his or her right to pursue enforcement action with the Department of Transportation. I noted earlier that training is an important piece as well. I noted that CROs must be trained to be the carrier expert in Part 382. They've got to go through CRO training at least on an annual basis. But carriers also must provide training for all of their personnel and contractors who deal with the traveling public as appropriate to the duties of each of those employees. That training must include such things as how to provide wheelchair assistance properly, the safe use of equipment, and appropriate ways of communicating with individuals with a disability. And with that, I'll turn it over to Ann to talk a little bit about our complaint handling.
Yes, so this is Ann, and so our complaint handling process is that initially when complaints come into our office, and we receive probably on average around 15,000 airline complaints a year, and that's regarding all types of matters regarding airline travel. And so, however, the ones that we receive regarding disability matters, everything is, those are the ones that we are required to do an investigation and forward to the carriers and require them to respond to the consumer within 30 days with a copy to our office. So as a result, when we receive the complaints, we code them particular ways, and then that way we're very gives us a good snapshot of where the trends are, where we're seeing increases or decreases in the types of complaints that we've gotten. So after the complaints are referred to the airline for a written response to the consumer and DOT, then once we receive those, our office, and it starts with on the analyst side, they will review the complaint and response from the airline. So we are looking at both sides of the issue to determine whether we believe any violations of the Air Carrier Access Act occurred. Once we've done that, we do send out what we call an investigation summary sheet. So we will summarize, you know, to the consumer what the decision was made by our office as to whether or not there was a violation, with an explanation. We do refer to the parts of the regulation, so they also are getting educated as to whether, you know, what the law requires the carriers to do. If we're seeing violations of regulations, particularly, we do look for trends, in the sense if we're seeing patterns and practices of a particular airline that we're seeing a significant amount of cases that we believe that they're, especially as we're looking at trends, if we notice an increase, you know, we may pursue some sort of enforcement action, and that's done through the attorney side. But basically, for every carrier, we have an assigned analyst and an attorney together, so they're working as a team to make their final conclusion. And I think just the one other thing I wanted to mention about this too is we do rely on, you know, consumers will tell us what their perspective is. So we are relying on what consumers advise us, you know, how specific, how detailed they are, and also from the airline side. If either is not very descriptive, you know, that makes it more of a challenge. So when we speak to consumers, we're always saying if you're going to write a complaint, to get as much, you know, as many specific details as you can. And we do require the airlines for what, you know, what we call a very dispositive response, that they're being very detailed as well in their response. So, okay, and this is a chart, and what we found out, and we apologize because we actually do have an updated chart, but just by our mistake, we forwarded an older one. So I'm going to give you the top five disability complaint categories, two for the last couple of years. I'll just note that, you know, here you'll see that the total DOT disability complaints that we've received and what the percentage is of all of the complaints that our office has received. And you'll see it runs the percentage has been very constant. In the past 2 years, in 2015, we received 940 complaints. So that was up a lot, but our complaints in general were also up. So they were like 4.6% of our total DOT complaints. And then our year-to-date complaints are up also. They're at 633 as of yesterday, which is also 4.6% of the total complaints that we've received. As far as when you're looking at just at that top category of 2014, so the top five categories, wheelchair assistance, that still remains. I won't give all the numbers for the past couple years, but I will mention that wheelchair assistance year-to-date, again, is 35%. Then we have an other assistance category, which that reflects, for example, somebody who may be blind who needs assistance to be brought to the gate but doesn't need wheelchair, so any other types of assistance not specific to wheelchair. So if you look at those two categories of wheelchair and other assistance for really end-planing, deep-planing, connecting service, that tends to be half of the complaints we receive. And we do believe this very much reflects to what the airlines receive. As far as the percentages, they receive probably hundreds of times more complaints than our office does, but the trends percentages tend to be the same. Now, I'll note in the past, the one thing that is not reflected in what you're looking at, but the past 2 years that we have seen a significant increase in is in the category of service animals. So service animal complaints in 2015, we had about 100 complaints. They went up 11%. And this year, we're about 84 complaints, and they're at 13%. So the service animal category used to be like our number five. It has moved up to the fourth highest complaint category. Again, otherwise, the other percentages run relatively the same. I think we've seen a little bit of a decrease in the feeding. But the one trend that we definitely want to note over the past couple of years is the service animal area.
And we could provide a copy of the updated numbers to Peter to disseminate to the group just so that you have the numbers that are current as of actually this week for 2016 and also the numbers that that we received in 2015. I think the salient point is that while we do receive a large number of disability complaints, in the grand scheme of the overall complaints that we receive, they're actually in the low end of the types of complaints that we receive. So for 2016, it was and 2015, it was only 4.6% of the actual total number of complaints that our office receives and handles. And you know, with Ann's description of the complaint numbers and the category of service animals rising to the fourth highest number of complaints that we received as far as disability related complaints, I think that's a good segue into the negotiated rulemaking that we're currently engaged in here at the department. And for those that are unfamiliar with a negotiated rulemaking, there's probably good reason for that. One, there aren't a lot of attorneys that are that familiar with negotiated rulemaking. It's not a process that's used as often as the regular notice and comment rulemaking that the federal government engages in. And it's really a process by which a federal agency forms a advisory committee of stakeholders who would have a significant interest in the outcome of a potential new rule and provides an opportunity for all of those individuals, including the federal government representative, to collaborate and try to work out the major provisions of a new rule. We started out with exploring six different categories, the feasibility of six different categories. And after our convener investigated those categories and interviewed the stakeholders, it was determined that three subject areas were really ripe for a negotiated rulemaking. Those are the issue of in-flight entertainment, accessible in-flight entertainment, issues dealing with service animals. What should the definition under the Air Carrier Access Act of a service animal be? The definition of a service animal under the ADA is different than that of the Air Carrier Access Act, and that the Air Carrier Access Act recognizes emotional support animals and also recognizes untrained animals and other unusual animals as well. And we talked at length at the last discussion that we had about the concerns about folks that were falsely claiming that their pets were service animals in an effort to avoid pet fees on aircraft and claiming that they were emotional support animals. So those are the two issues that the advisory committee is dealing with now in the context of a negotiated rulemaking with respect to service animals. The third issue is whether or not to require accessible laboratories on new single-aisle aircraft. And that, from a public health standpoint, is probably the most important issue out of all three of these, quite frankly. When the department first issued its rules requiring accessible laboratories on dual-aisle aircraft, there simply just wasn't enough in the way of data to show that that single-aisle aircraft were used for long-haul flights. Generally, long-haul flights were flown by wide-body aircraft with dual aisles. Narrow-body aircraft such as 737s and DC-9s at the time and the like generally flew shorter routes, 1 to 2 to 3 hours maximum. However, in recent years, single-aisle aircraft have been used to fly longer and longer routes, cross-continental routes, in some cases, flights to Europe and to points in South America. Often these flights are now lasting 5 hours or more. And if you add in the amount of time that it takes to board an aircraft and get the aircraft ready for takeoff and to actually taxi and take off, and then on the back end to land and actually get to a terminal and deplane and get to a place where you can actually use the bathroom, there's a significant amount of time that is tacked on to the actual flight time. And so what that is ending up with is circumstances where individuals have to take rather drastic measures to ensure that they don't need to use the restroom if they indeed cannot, if they're not physically able to do so on a single aisle aircraft. So that's one of the issues that the advisory committee is looking into as well. The advisory committee has had 5 meetings so far this year, and the 6th meeting is scheduled for October 12th in Arlington, and there'll be information that'll be posted on that on our website. And you can, it's easiest to Google the website rather than typing in the URL. It's a little lengthy. If you Google Access ACCESS Advisory Committee, DOT, then you'll easily find our website. I can also provide the URL directly to Peter, and he can further disseminate it. But we've got all the information on there, all the documents that have been presented to the advisory committee during the plenary sessions, and just a lot of other interesting information on the members and ground rules and the like.
Right. And another big piece of what our office does is outreach. And these are just some of the examples. So one of the things is we do speak at forums or we speak on calls such as this, and we do this with groups, whether it is advocacy, industry, organizations, carriers, and so on. We find this is an opportunity, you know, to engage with others, and it's always great to hear questions too. The next is, so with industry, airline representatives, another piece that we do is we issue industry and consumer guidance, and at the end of our discussion, we'll give some contact information, which we'll also send email that as well, so that can be provided as far as to our website. But we, on the website, we provide a lot of information, especially when it comes to even consumer guidance, there may be parts that our regulation doesn't exactly touch on that we may give more of a description. Then I think LaVon mentioned the plan is to do a technical assist manual update that gets very much into the specifics of the regulation, and that would be a tool for people to use, whether it's the airlines or the consumers, which gets into more details about expectations with the Air Carrier Access Act or recommendations or suggestions as well. Another piece of what we do is we've mentioned about the consumer or the complaint resolution official, the CRO. So we like to attend training classes. The airlines are required to provide training for CROs for new hires and also on a regular basis. So whether that's training or customer service classes, really we're there to more participate and engage and offer suggestions to the airlines, because the trainings very much vary. So that's also helpful for us, for our staff as well, just to kind of see what and how things are being communicated. We provide a disability hotline number. This was required by Congress, and it is a number Monday through Friday. Really the intent for the disability hotline number is to deal with real-time issues, particularly at the airport, for either consumers or for airline personnel to contact us. Then finally, disability forums. So we, in the past, have offered forums that we've opened up to carriers, advocates to come and, to educate them more on our regulation. Because of the regulatory negotiation meetings that have been going on this year, that is kind of cast aside for this year anyway, the plans to do a forum, but we are hoping in the next year or so to offer another one. And I think, that's it. And what I will be doing is we do have, as I mentioned, there's a lot of resources on our website that's available. And what I'll just say over the audio is that it's at www.transportation.gov/airconsumer. So that's our main website, and this includes, as we said, guidance documents, FAQs, a lot of information on how to file a complaint, travel tips publications, our disability hotline number, and so forth. So it's just a great resource of information.
Okay, and that concludes the substantive portion of our presentation. And with that, we'll take any questions about the rule or regulatory negotiation or our program.
All right, great. Thank you both for all of that information. Yeah, if any additional information you want to send to us, updated complaint information, we will include that when the archive is posted, so folks can access that additional information that you want to send to us.
Sounds great.
Gabrielle, at this time, I'm going to have you come back and give our telephone participants instructions on how they can ask a question. For those of you in the webinar room, remember you can submit your question directly into the chat area and click on that, or Control-M for those using assistive technology will focus in the chat area. While you will not see your question once it is submitted, it is viewable by the speakers. And those of you connecting via a mobile app, you can type your question directly into the chat area. So, Gabriel, if you would give our telephone participants instructions, please.
Yes, sir. Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you have a question at this time, please press the star, then the number one key on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered or you wish to remove yourself from the queue, please press the pound key. One moment, please, for questions.
All right, Gabriel, while we wait to get our telephone questions in, we've had some questions submitted in the webinar room and some questions submitted in advance. The questioner wants to know about the negotiated rulemaking process, and is there any public comment component to that type of rulemaking process?
Yes, there is. In addition to the Access Advisory Committee website, there is a docket that we post all of the documents that are made public during the regulatory negotiation. I'm going to try to pull that docket number up now and provide it. If you can bear with me just for a moment. Okay, if you go to www.regulations.gov, the docket ID number that you would enter into the search box is DOT for Department of Transportation dash OST dash 2015 dash 0246. And there you can post comments to the docket. You can also see other information that's been posted to the docket by members of the public and by the department.
Okay, we'll go ahead and post that information into the chat area so folks can view that. A couple questions that came in earlier. Just a quick clarification on the application to the airport facilities itself. Is that ADA or is that ACA, Air Carrier Access?
So there is some crossing of jurisdictional boundaries with respect to airports. So for facilities that airlines own, lease, or control, there are certain provisions that are in Part 382 that would be applicable to airlines. However, with respect to airports themselves, that would fall under either ADA or Section 504 of the Rehab Act, and the FAA's Office of Civil Rights would be the office that would have jurisdiction specifically over enforcement of those laws with respect to airport operators.
Okay, very good. I had a question. The first question came in reference to slide 16, so I'll give you a chance to get back to that. And the question had to do with the phrase special services. If you could give an example of special services that someone with a disability would not be required to use or access.
What that references is such things as as an individual with a disability, they can't require you to use a wheelchair. If you say, for instance, you're blind and you request assistance to the gate, they can't require that you take a wheelchair and not just assist you in walking to the gate if that's your preference. They also can't require you to sit in a designated seating area for individuals with disabilities. They can't, you know, just assemble an area that they designate specifically for individuals with disabilities and require that in order for you to, you know, fly, you've got to sit here. Or in order for you to receive an accommodation such as end planning and deplaning or pre-boarding, you've got to sit here. So they can't require you to accept a special service under Part 382, and that's what that means.
Okay. Excellent clarification. Let's check in quickly with Gabriel, see if we have any questions from any of our telephone participants at this time.
Yes, sir. Again, if you have a question at this time, please press star, then the number one key on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered or you wish to remove yourself from the queue, please press the pound key. One moment, please, for questions.
All right. We'll move on. We've got other questions that have been submitted. Someone wanted the clarification regarding the requirements for the timeline for website accessibility and then also requirements for kiosk and airline apps that can be used for either getting a paper boarding ticket or using an electronic boarding ticket through an airline app.
Okay, so with respect to, let's see if I can find the slide. Just bear with me just for a moment. Slide 16. No, it's not slide 16. Did I pass it? Okay. And so essentially the website accessibility provisions were or are to occur in two phases. The first phase was December 12, 2015. Airlines were required to ensure that their core functions on their web pages were made accessible. And those include such things as booking, changing reservations, checking in, accessing your itinerary, your flight status, frequent flyer accounts, flight schedules, and contact information. The second phase, and also the online request form for individuals with disabilities. The second phase is to occur this December, and that December, I believe December 12th of this year, it's either December 12th or December 13th, I would have to look at the exact language of the rule. I think it may be after December 12th, so I think it's December 13th. But in phase two, airlines are required to ensure that the remaining pages on their website that they market to U.S. customers are accessible to the Web Content Accessibility Guidelines 2.0 level AA. And with respect to kiosks, there is a requirement that both proprietary, which are airline-owned kiosks, and shared-use kiosks that are installed after December 12th of 2016 meet accessibility standards that are specified in the kiosk rule. So for any airline-owned kiosk that is installed after December 12th of this year, they've got to install an accessible kiosk until 20% of the kiosks in a given location at a specific airport meet the accessibility standards. And within 10 years of the original promulgation date of the rule, which was in 2013, so by 2023, regardless of whether or not airlines have been replacing kiosks up until then, they've got to ensure within 10 years that 20% of the kiosks in a given location at an airport are accessible. And the same goes for shared use. And shared use kiosks are kiosks that can be owned by an airline, can be owned by an airport, it can be owned by a contract vendor. The rule requires that 20% of those kiosks be accessible by 2023 and that any kiosks that are replaced after December 12th of this year be accessible, and that the software used for those kiosks is accessible as well.
All right, thanks for that clarification. It's one of those interesting areas as technology continues to evolve in 2023. Will airlines, airports still be using kiosks to disseminate boarding tickets or boarding passes, or we've moved on to another means? Just another quick clarification with regards to the web accessibility requirements. Someone wanted a clarification on those requirements. Do those apply solely to the airlines, or does that also include other travel websites that allow individuals to book flights on air carriers, planes?
Yeah, the specific website rule applies to airlines, but there is a provision. I want to try to find it here. So under, and now I'm getting technical as a lawyer, under 14 CFR 39980, I'll just read the section. It is the policy of the department to regard as an unfair or deceptive practice or unfair method of competition the practices enumerated in paragraphs A through M of this section by a ticket agent of any size and the practice enumerated in paragraph S by a ticket agent that sells air transportation online by failing to disclose or offer web-based discount fares on or after June 10, 2014 to prospective passengers who contact the agent through other channels, e.g. by telephone or in the agent's place of business, and indicate they are unable to use the agent's website due to a disability. So there is a provision that's applicable to ticket agents, but the website accessibility provision is specifically applicable to airlines.
Okay, very good. Thank you for that clarification. I'm going to go to a question that was emailed in advance, and the question about to what extent is physical assistance is required from airline personnel, i.e., are they required to lift someone who may not be able to assist, you know, from the aisle chair into the seat? And the questioner said that they attended a conference where they were someone that consults with airlines said that the airline personnel would have to provide that type of assistance in lifting someone, you know, into and out of the aisle seat.
Yes, that's correct. Airline personnel, including flight attendants, are required to physically assist and assist the person into and out of their seat. And that includes circumstances where an individual needs to use an aisle chair on board the aircraft to get to an accessible lavatory. There are, however, certain circumstances where a flight attendant or a pair of flight attendants just may not physically be able to do so. So we handle those situations on a case-by-case basis. But generally, airlines have employ individuals, while on the ground at least, who are physically capable of assisting the vast majority of individuals in an aisle chair and from the aisle chair to their seat. There are always circumstances, exceptions, where the person may just be too large to fit down the aisle or too large for the individuals to physically be able to assist them. Those are rare, but they're handled on a case-by-case basis.
Right. Very good. To another question that was submitted. Someone wanting a clarification when you early on talked about the definition of who is a qualified person with a disability and included individuals with temporary disabilities. This questioner wants to know if similar to the ADA, that there are protections for persons that are associated with someone, an air traveler with a disability, or an air traveler that may be regarded as or treated as though they have a disability.
Yes, so as I noted, the definition of a qualified individual with a disability specifically does include an individual who has a temporary disability. So if you go on vacation to Aspen and you go skiing and you break your leg, the airlines would be required to provide any necessary accommodations to you pursuant to Part 382. The rule does also include within its definition, and I'm trying to find it here on the fly, individual who is either regarded as or who has a history of a such an impairment. So basically, under the definition of the term of physical or mental impairment, it discusses major life activities, and it also talks about individuals who, an individual who has a record of an impairment, has a history of, or has been classified or misclassified as having a mental or physical impairment that substantially limits one or more major life activities. Is regarded as having an impairment means has a mental, has a physical or mental impairment that does not substantially limit major life activities, but that is treated by an air carrier as constituting such a limitation. who has a physical or mental impairment that substantially limits a major life activity only as the result of attitudes of others towards such an impairment, or has none of the impairments set forth in the definition but is treated by an air carrier as having such an impairment. And I guess the question that I would have for clarification is with regard to, I think that the individual had asked, one who is accompanying the individual. Can I get a little clarification on the specific question surrounding that?
Yeah, I think the association question dealt with, you know, if someone was denied travel based on their association. So say an airline, you know, refuses to transport someone because of said disability, and there's a family member, a friend, a companion with that individual who, because of that, you know, denial of the person with a disability, is also unable to travel.
You know, I would need to think about that one. As a general matter, under that circumstance, the airline may be in violation if the denial was on the basis of the individual's disability. Anne, would you have more to add to that?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, I'd have to think on that as well.
I mean, if you're not regarded as having a record, if you're not a qualified individual, mm-hmm. individual with a disability, if you don't have a record of having an impairment that substantially limits a major life activity, or if you're not regarded, my instinct is to say that you specifically would not be covered by the rule. But there are certain circumstances where airlines have to ensure that their facilities are accessible to individuals with disabilities who are not actually passengers, but who are traveling with passengers who are disabilities. But yes, that's a very good question. My instinct is that the person accompanying would not be covered specifically under Part 382, but that would be something I would need to look into further.
Okay, very good. I'm going to check with Gabriel one more time here. You don't need to give instructions. Just let me know if there are any questions on the telephone at this time.
Sarah, I'm not seeing any questions at this time.
Okay. Folks know how to get in the queue if they need to. A quick follow-up question to the kiosk requirements. The questioner wanted to know, is there any requirement for having signage at inaccessible kiosks directing persons to the location of the accessible kiosk?
I would need to take a look here.
All right, if you want to take a look at that one, perhaps we've got another one here that perhaps we can speak to. This has to do with an individual that is deaf and wants to communicate with the CRO because of an issue. What are the obligations of the airline in terms of communicating with that passenger that is deaf that wants to resolve a particular issue?
Yeah, so the airline would certainly be under an obligation to establish a means of communicating with a deaf passenger. Mm-hmm. And so generally that would be in the form of either writing or typing something. But they would be under an obligation to attempt in good faith, reasonably, to establish a means of communication, and they would certainly be under an obligation to provide a CRO to that individual and to ensure that the CRO or the CRO would be under an obligation to ensure that they can establish a means of communication as well.
Yeah. And I'll just add to that too, because I think you know, I always think of options, you know, what even, you know, people are going to communicate different ways, and what may work for one person may not for somebody else. But we've been engaged too with a lot with the deaf community, and really it's amazing with the electronic devices out there that has made it much more easy access, you know, to even someone to type in, and many individuals who are deaf, you know, have that type of mobile device. Otherwise, it's just ask, you know, communicating with them as a piece of paper and pen, okay. But I think it's being just sensitive to possible, you know, different options for different people.
All right, very good, very good. In the technology piece, that's a great point. Various ways to communicate nowadays that weren't available previously. Did you want to wait on the kiosk signage question, or?
I'm taking a quick look at the provisions of the rule now, and it clearly requires that for each automated airport kiosk that meets the specifications for accessibility must also be visually and tactilely identifiable to users as accessible. For example, by utilizing the international symbol of accessibility affixed to the front of the device. I don't see a specific requirement here for airport signage that would direct one to an accessible kiosk. I would have to do a little more digging to see if that might be something that we would require or that the FAA might require. But certainly the kiosk itself must be visually and tactilely identifiable as accessible.
All right, very good. We have another question submitted through the webinar platform. Someone's asking for clarification under the rule, and they want to know if they understood correctly that a person with a disability has the right to pre-board, and what is available to them in the event that the airline denies that person the ability to pre-board.
Yes, so if you have an individual, if you're an individual with a disability and you need extra time, you need to board via a aisle chair. If you need to stow accessibility equipment, then you would be under an obligation to notify the airline at the gate to self-disclose that of your need to pre-board and avail yourself of that opportunity when it arises. Airlines aren't under an obligation to make announcements about pre-boarding. Generally, they do, so it's a good idea once you have spoken to the airline representative to ensure that you're aware of when pre-boarding is expected to occur. But in terms of if the airline refuses to allow you to pre-board and you feel like they did so erroneously or in contradiction to the provisions of Part 382, my recommendation is to ask to speak to a CRO and explain what the circumstances are and see if the CRO can assist in allowing you to pre-board. If in the event you're still unsuccessful, you can give our disability hotline a telephone call if it's during normal business hours, or if all else fails and the very unfortunate circumstance occurs where you're not allowed to pre-board, then you can certainly file a complaint with our office.
All right, excellent. Thank you for that information. You addressed this back in your session earlier this year, but it wouldn't be a session without a question regarding service animals. And a person wants information on what are the current requirements related to animal relief areas within the airport, and are there any proposed changes to the current requirements for those areas?
Okay, so a rule requiring service animal relief areas to be in the secure side of each airport terminal took effect actually this past August. So with respect to Part 382, applies to airlines. There's a rule that applies to airports as well, and that's Part 27, and that's something that the FAA would enforce. But Part 382 requires airlines to work with airports to ensure that there are service animal relief areas at the airport. Part 27 specifically requires airports to have a service animal relief area, and I'm trying to find the specific language so I can state it as accurately as I possibly can. Do you bear with me just for a moment?
Absolutely. And remember, there's still for those of you in the webinar room, you still have time to submit the questions if you have them.
Okay, so what the rule requires, and again, this is an airport requirement, so for each airport with 10,000 or more annual employments, it requires airlines to consult with one or more service animal training organizations regarding the design, dimensions, materials, and maintenance of service animal relief areas. It requires airports to establish at least one relief area in each airport terminal. The airports must establish the relief area and the sterile area of each airport terminal unless TSA, the airline and the service animal in the airport and the service animal training organization all agree that it would be better to not have the service animal relief area in the sterile area of the airport terminal. And that provision is in there just as an aside because this rule applies to airports with 10,000 or more annual employments. Those are classified as non-hub airports. And often they're very small airports. There's some of the smaller, more rural airports, and they can be just one small room is really what the size of the passenger holding area, and it just really wouldn't make sense to have a service animal relief area in there. But for all intents and purposes, airports and airlines are required by the law to work together to ensure that service animal relief areas, there's at least one service animal relief area in the sterile area of each airport that has 10,000 or more annual employments.
Okay, thank you for the clarification, and I had a follow-up question from someone that, according to their own experience in their travel since the effective date of that back in this past August, that they have encountered airports that that do not have the service animal relief areas within the security areas. And the questioner wants to know, is the agency doing anything in terms of, you know, highlighting, sending out information to airport operators, airlines, to, you know, remind them of this new requirement?
That's a question really for the FAA, since they enforce the Part 27 requirements against airports. I can tell you that we have received numerous inquiries from individuals about the Part 27 requirements. I think that airports are well aware of the Part 27 requirements to the extent that we have gotten any, and I'm not sure even anecdotally to what degree we've gotten complaints from individuals about service animal relief areas. I don't know if you know, Anne.
Yeah, you know, I actually recently checked because that question had come up as far as, and we did get a handful, but the question more with the service animal relief areas was actually more specific to either employees, whether they were airline employees or airport employees, either did not know where they were, or there was issues of just not knowing where the signs were. Yeah. So it was more an issue of finding a location. But I think we were even asked, was there any specific complaints that we've received, you know, regarding the service animal areas, you know, as far as just the construction of them or how they were, or conducive or for their animals, but we have not seen any complaints like that so far.
Yeah, so to the extent that we do receive those, if it's a complaint that's involving an airline, we'll investigate the complaint with the airline. If it's a complaint that's involving an airport directly, we'll refer that complaint to the FAA. Just in terms of some of the things that have been done, I know the FAA is working on an advisory circular regarding service animal relief areas, providing more detailed information to airports. Every year also, the FAA has a civil rights conference for airports. Generally, I think it's 4 or 5 days long. It's usually in August or September. Last year, they did have one, and they invited a rather large number of airports. And one of the topics that was discussed specifically in detail was the service animal relief area requirements. But what I would suggest, apart from the efforts that the department and the FAA have taken to ensure that airports are aware of these requirements and implementing them, to the extent that you do find an airport that you believe may be in violation of this rule, that you submit a complaint. You can send the complaint to us, and we'll ensure that it gets to the FAA, or you can send it to the FAA directly.
All right, excellent information. One last service animal question before we get to the bottom of the hour here. And this goes back to slide 24, just to give you a reference. And the questioner, when you were discussing that slide, talked about the airline's obligation to accept from the person, you know, assurances that they are a person with a disability, and that the service, the animal is in fact a service animal. And you had used the word credible. So examples of where, an airline could point to say to an action or something of the animal saying, you know, that's not a service animal, if you have an example.
Trying to think of a specific example that might really be helpful. Unfortunately, there are some individuals that do exist in society who may attempt to pass off a service animal, a pet as a service animal. Generally, service animals are trained to behave in public. Generally, and often, although it's not required specifically by Part 382, they're often trained to provide the assistance that they're providing to an individual. So if, for example, an individual is indicating that a given animal is their service animal, but it's running all over the airport holding area, it's barking at people or barking at other animals, it's jumping on people, maybe even biting people, if it's urinating or defecating, or if there are any other real telltale signs that the animal may not be a service animal as is being offered by that individual, then the airline may believe that the verbal assurances of that person are not credible, and then seek to ask for other things or look for harnesses or ask for documentation that the animal is indeed a service animal. But if the animal is not behaving, then that is always potential grounds for not accepting the animal if the animal can't calm down or can't be assured to behave on board the aircraft. And I don't know if you wanted to add anything to that.
Yeah, no, I think you covered it well.
Okay.
Yeah, thank you. I think those are some great examples. Well, we have reached the bottom of the hour. I want to thank both Yvonne and Ann, not only for your participation today, but also for your preparation in getting ready for today's session. We truly appreciate that on behalf of the UD National Network, as do the participants of today's session. As a reminder, Levon and Ann will be sending some additional updated information to us that will be posted with the archive. The archive of today's session will be available within 24 hours on the ADA audio conference website, ada-audio.org. The edited transcript of today's session will be posted at a later date. Our next session in the audio conference series will kick off our new year, 2016-2017. That will take place on October the 18th. The topic still to be determined. For those of you that have participated in the past, you will be notified through the listserv. For others, you can stay tuned to the ADA audio website to get information when we post the session and registration information for that session. If you have questions about the audio conference series, you can always contact us at 877-232-1990. So again, thanks again to our presenters, and most of all, thanks to all of you who participated in today's session. For those of you in the webinar room, you can disconnect by closing your internet browser. For those on the telephone, you can simply hang up. Thank you, and have a good day.